This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, December 8th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. In October, at a campaign rally in Green Bay, Wisconsin, Donald Trump talked about government corruption and what he would do about it.
It is time to drain the swamp in Washington, D.C. This is why I'm proposing a package of ethics reforms to make our government honest once again. When Bill Clinton came into office, he signed an executive order saying if you work for the White House or a federal agency, you can't lobby the government for 5 years after you leave. But then President Clinton did what the Clintons always do. He rigged the system on his way out, right? Clinton lifted the executive order so Clinton cronies like John Podesta could start raking in cash.
John Cassidy joins me to discuss concerns about the potential ethical problems posed by the Trump administration. Hey, John.
Hi, Dorothy.
One of Trump's major promises during his campaign, and we heard some of it above, was to make the government honest again, which included, above all, really, curbing the influence of lobbyists. This week, we learned that former Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole brokered a phone call recently between Trump and the president of Taiwan. So that has obvious diplomatic ramifications for our relationship with China. But was it a real breach with protocol, given how business has always been done in Washington?
Well, I think it was obviously a breach with the American foreign policy of the last, since 1979, no American leader has spoke to a Taiwanese leader because the U.S. official policy has been to respect China's one China policy. So that, it was a diplomatic breach, but it also brought up, you know, the whole conflict of interest question because Trump, although he doesn't have any business interests in Taiwan at the moment, he may have at some point in the future. It's emerged that one of his executives, the executive who runs his Asian hotels, visited the country earlier this year. And then, of course, there's Bob Dole's involvement. He's now a registered lobbyist for the Taiwanese government. Maybe surprising to some people to think a former presidential candidate would do that, but that's what he's doing. So, it doesn't look very good if you're draining the swamp and you're speaking to a Taiwanese prime minister on a call arranged by a lobbyist.
Take us back a little bit. You and I both lived in Washington back in the 80s, and that was the time when Fred Dutton, who was an advisor to JFK and RFK, and became the chief flack of the Saudi royal family. So he was the example of the revolving door at its most flagrant. Talk a little bit about how business has always been done in Washington.
Right. I mean, it's very easy to be cynical if you spend quite a lot of time in Washington. And Dutton actually was one of the first big lobbyists I came across when I started reporting on the first Bush administration in the run-up to the first Gulf War. He was representing the Saudis and arranging interviews, etc. Some people looked askance upon it, but people in Washington just sort of thought that's how the world works. Ever since then, of course, it's become a bigger issue. The original sort of Tea Party, Gingrichites back in the mid-90s claimed that they were all about getting rid of lobbyists. Turned out that most of them, or a lot of them, turned into lobbyists or had deals with lobbyists, etc. It is easy to be cynical about all this. Trump, though, did, as you said in the introduction, basically come out and make it a central part of his sort of campaign platform to, as he said, drain the swamp. And I think even for veteran Washington people, it was pretty shocking that it turned out that the transition, at least under Chris Christie, was stuffed full of lobbyists. Since Mike Pence has taken over, he has instituted a sort of no-lobbyist rule, but I think people are still pretty skeptical as to whether they're going to
go away. A few former lobbyists have crept in, have they not, into his appointments?
I don't think they've actually been appointed yet. I mean, he did fire some people in the transition, but of course, he's appointing to his cabinet not so much lobbyists, but, billionaires who are the sort of people who hire lobbyists. So you can make the argument that rather than hiring the sort of agents of these powerful interest groups, he's actually hiring the people who run these powerful interest groups, people like Wilbur Ross and Steve Mnuchin, Betsy DeVos. They're all extremely wealthy people, and to say that you're draining the swamp and then hand over the cabinet or parts of the cabinet to a bunch of billionaires. I mean, one of the sort of tragic things that's happened in the last couple of days, of course, is we've seen Al Gore go in to see Trump, and Leonardo DiCaprio as well, both talking about the environment and the need to foster green jobs. And then, you know, lo and behold, Trump appoints a, basically a tool of the oil industry as to head up the EPA.
And a climate change denier.
And a climate change denier. So is what's happening here Mike Pence basically making the choices? Or is Trump himself just being, you know, completely two-faced? In either case, you know, it's another sort of sign that we should take what Trump says and the sort of PR images he puts out from Trump Tower very skeptically and concentrate on what he actually does.
But this runs completely contrary to what he said during his campaign, especially the big money interest. His entire populist platform seems to be undercut by what everything he has done since he was elected.
From inside the liberal bubble, which is where we live, it does seem like a big contradiction. I think most of Trump supporters are still just in a honeymoon period. Contrary to what is sometimes said, I don't think most of the people out there in the country are following every tweet and every sort of cough and splutter of what's happening in the transition. Almost always in history, presidents' approval ratings rise between the moment of their election and when they get inaugurated. And in Trump's case, what we've seen is that his approval ratings have basically gone up from the high 30s, which, you know, the lowest in history, to the mid 40s. So it's not like suddenly a great majority of the country have decided that Trump is a great guy. You see it even from Trump's rallies. They're not packed anymore. Most people have basically said, OK, he's elected. We'll tune back in, you know, when he becomes president.
OK, well, but in the meantime, we will do our job and continue on this subject. So how extensive are his business interests? I think I read in The Washington Post that he has over 100 companies that have done business in at least 18 countries.
There's 18 countries dotted all around the world, including, you know, sensitive countries in the Middle East, like the some of the Gulf Kingdoms, et cetera, more than 100 companies. It's not just that he has large interests. It's that As one of our colleagues, Adam Davidson, pointed out in a piece, he's actually been expanding pretty rapidly in the last couple of years through this sort of hotels deal. Trump is basically a franchisee. He sells his brand to anybody around the world who wants to put up a hotel with him on it, as long as they pay him the requisite fee. And they've been expanding all over the place. So whether they launched the expansion knowing that he was going to announced for president, or whether it was a coincidence, I don't think we know yet. But there are sort of blatant conflicts of interest. There's never been anything like this, going back to at least for the last 100 years or so, where we've had a president coming into power with such an extensive set of interests around the world.
And let's just zero in. What are the political ramifications, say, just in the Middle East?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, Saudi Arabia, for example, Trump has been very critical of, you know, on the campaign trail, claiming Hillary was tied to the Saudis, saying, you know, criticizing them for their treatment of women, treatment of gays, etc., for being repressive. Turns out that he's registered a bunch of companies in Saudi Arabia over the last year. You know, why has he done that? Presumably to, you know, do some sort of a hotel deal. There's rumors of a hotel deal in Jeddah. Are they going to go ahead now while Trump's talking to the Saudis about all the issues in the Middle East? I mean, the U.S.-Saudi Arabian relationship is one of the most sensitive in the world. And, you know, in the last few years, it's been very rocky as the Obama administration has reached out to Iran, or done deal with Iran, and cooperating with them in Iraq on the attack on ISIS. Saudi relations are already rocky. Is Trump really an independent player in that relationship? Well, not if he's got, you know, potential business interests with the Saudi royal family.
Trump announced on Twitter that he's going to hold his first press conference next week, and he said that it's visually important, as he put it, as president, to in no way have a conflict of interest with my various businesses. What is he likely to say, and what does he mean by visually important?
I think he realizes that this is a big issue, and you know, it could haunt him throughout his presidency, because obviously it won't go away. Whatever arrangement he strikes next week, he'll then have to live with for the next 4 years. But I think it's very unlikely that it'll actually go as far as most critics, including myself, have said. I mean, when this all came up a couple of weeks ago, I think there was a sort of general consensus in the media and among ethics lawyers that if he really wants to get rid of his conflicts of interest, the only way he can do it is by liquidating his interests, i.e. selling his interests in the businesses. If he hands them over to his family, for example, you know, that just means he's still involved at one remove, and his family members played an integral part of the transition process. So the idea that just moving the control to his family would insulate him from the business, I think, is ridiculous. Even the Wall Street Journal's conservative editorial page said a couple of weeks ago that the only really viable solution to this is for Trump to liquidate his businesses. But I don't think anybody really expects him to go that far. I think what we'll get next week is some sort of a sort of halfway house based on the idea of handing over control to his family. Perhaps he'll even say that he's selling his own interests, you know, passing them along to his daughter and sons so that he doesn't have an ownership stake. And possibly bring in some sort of outsider to help run, although he hasn't even said that. The sort of conventional wisdom is that he'll try and get away with as little as he can.
What about Ivanka? It sounds as though she might take a leave of absence from the Trump Organization and appoint a president of her company because, of course, she has her own Trump-branded company.
Yeah, I mean, that's a crazy thing. I mean, one of the controversies which has erupted is that she was in the meeting with the Prime Minister of Japan at the same time as she's recently done a big deal with a clothing company in Japan. So she has not as large but similar set of conflicts of interest as Trump does. And, you know, now she seems to be playing a very integral role. It seems to be her who introduced Al Gore to Trump, who was in Trump Tower the other day. Yep. So I think if she does want to get involved in the presidency itself, she's going to face the same calls as he is.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
The legalities of all of this are confusing. So we're already hearing a lot about the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. You cited Richard Painter, who's a former government ethics lawyer for George W. Bush, and others who say that if Trump doesn't entirely divest himself of his business holdings, he could be violating the Constitution.
There are two big issues here. One, as Trump points out, the more basic sort of just conflicts of interest laws and clauses of the Constitution, which apply to most federal officials, do not, for historical reasons, apply to the president and vice president. And that goes back to the start of the Republic when the presidents and vice presidents were very wealthy men, and the Congress basically gave them a break, I think. They realized that people like Washington would inevitably have business interests in some of the decisions they were making about agriculture and tariffs and things like that. So they basically excluded the president and vice president from those laws, and that's still the situation today. So a few days after the election, you heard Trump coming out crowing, saying, oh, you've heard my lawyers have told me that these laws don't apply to me. So now what's happening is some constitutional lawyers, including the ones you mentioned, have said, hey, hold on a minute. There is still part of the Constitution, the so-called Emoluments Clause, which does apply to the president. And what that clause says is that it's against the Constitution for the president to receive any stream of income, direct or indirect, from foreign governments. Now, what Trump would argue is he isn't getting money from foreign governments. But if you're doing deals with places like the Gulf Kingdoms or other sort of quasi-dictatorships around the world, it's very blurred, the line between the government and the private sector. This is going to be a big issue, I think, once Trump comes out with his much less far-reaching set of conflict of interest guidelines. These lawyers will make the argument that he's in violation of the Constitution. Two more issues here. Number one, are they right? I'm not a constitutional lawyer. I don't know. Some people say they are. Lawrence Tribe, the eminent Harvard professor, agrees with them and says this is a constitutional crisis. But even if it is a constitutional crisis, the question is who's going to press it? The only way you could really hold Trump to account on this is for him to be impeached. And at the moment, there seems to be absolutely no appetite whatsoever among the Republicans to make a big issue of this.
But what about Democratic members of Congress? I see that already there's some movement toward making this a big issue. Representative Maxine Waters has called on the inspectors general of eight agencies, I think including Treasury and Justice, to root out, as she put it, any potential conflicts of interest.
Oh, I think the Democrats are going to, I mean, this will be one of their big issues, maybe the big issue of the next year or so for them. They may have divisions on some things, but there's no divisions whatsoever on the idea that Trump is hopelessly conflicted here and that it might have some popular resonance. So I think they'll be calling for all sorts of things, but the question is, what can they do? If the Democrats had taken over the Senate, which they nearly did but didn't quite make it, they could, of course, have held hearings. But all the committees are going to be under Republican control, and so far none of the committee chairs have sort of broken ranks with the Paul Ryan line, which is that we just sort of turn a blind eye to this.
And what about Paul Ryan? Is he going to be able to maintain that and also keep his own sort of raucous caucus in line?
I mean, that's, you know, a fascinating question. The conspiracy theory among the sort of, you know, people who wish Trump ill is that eventually the Republicans will use this as a way of getting rid of Trump. Obviously, there's no love lost between Paul Ryan and Donald Trump. So, you know, some people are still holding out hope that at some point, if a particular scandal arises involving one of Trump's businesses, they could use it as an excuse to impeach him and get rid of him. But I think at the moment, there's no sign of that happening. I mean, basically, Ryan and McConnell appear to have done a sort of made a Faustian pact with Trump in which they sort of turn a blind eye to it. And in return, Trump is going along with a lot of the sort of traditional right-wing Republican legislative agenda, getting rid of Obamacare, big tax cuts, reducing regulations, even talk of tackling entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare, even though during the campaign, Trump said he'd protect Social Security or maybe even increase the benefits.
So what's happened to the Never Trump movement?
Well, it seems to have disappeared, right? I mean, even Mitt Romney was the leader of the Never Trump movement, and now he's having dinner, you know, with Trump discussing a Secretary of State job. It's certainly true there are still some media figures and sort of intellectuals in Washington, Bill Kristol and the like, who are still in the Never Trump camp. But, you know, to have any real influence, they need a big sort of lobby on Capitol Hill. And we just don't have that at the moment. It looks like Rand Paul, for example, would be willing to go against Trump on certain issues. He said that he'll reject certain of the appointees. But you know, Rand Paul can't do it all by himself.
Lindsey Graham, too, it sounds as though he's going to be holding hearings on the issue of Russian interference.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was actually a sort of promising development. I mean, obviously, the whole question of what Trump's interests, if he has any in Russia, are Democrats tried to make a big issue of during the campaign. Certainly a lot of people, if you speak to people in the Clinton campaign, they certainly thought, you know, it's a big issue. If Graham is serious about looking into that issue, it could be interesting hearings.
We have to get back to the liberal media. Trump tweeted last month, "Prior to the election, it was well known that I have interests in properties all over the world. Only the crooked media makes this a big deal." So the crooked media continues to play into his hands. I've been talking to a number of people here about this in recent days. What can the mainstream media do to effectively come back at Trump?
It's a very good question. I mean, it's funny how he's now, you know, instead of crooked Hillary, it's now the crooked media. He's using the same tactics against the media that he used against
exactly.
Hillary. I mean, I think one of the things we can do is, you know, try not to react to every single sort of outrageous tweet, for example, and focus on some of the real issues. And one of the real issues is, of course, this conflict of interest question. I've been arguing for weeks that this is where, you know, the media should be focusing as much attention as it can. The problem is, from the media's perspective, and the advantage for Trump's perspective, is it's not clear whether the sort of media outrage is reflected in public opinion. There was a Bloomberg poll a couple of days ago which suggested that 51% of the population are confident that Trump will put his nation's interests before his own business interests. I think if you poll journalists, you'd probably get 10%, maybe you'd say that. So there was another question saying, you know, what should we do to force Trump to deal with his conflict of interest? Does it go too far to force him to sell his businesses, which most people in the media think is a good idea? And 69% of respondents said that that went too far. Trump is sure to seize upon these numbers and sort of repeat the argument, look, this is just an elite argument and the people in the country don't care about it. At this stage, he may be right, but as the administration proceeds, it's going to be up to the media to actually point out specific cases. And if they can come up with an egregious case where Trump clearly was, you know, benefit his own interests and he's president at the time, of course, he's not president now. So, you know, these things are not as resonant as they would be if he was actually president. If it can be shown that he made a decision that directly benefit his own family or himself, which I think is perfectly possible, then I think it would have more resonance. So I think it's, you know, an issue for the media going forward. We've got to be on this and examining everything he does closely.
Thanks so much, John. John Cassidy is a staff writer and the author of, most recently, How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com or on the New Yorker Today app, a great way to read The New Yorker on your mobile device, available at no extra charge from the App Store or at NewYorker.com/today. Tell us what you thought of this podcast. Rate and review The Political Scene on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.